Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
Irrespective of the particular drama that the LA Times has been through with bankruptcy and a series of differing corporate owners with differing objectives, I think we've got stable ownership or an independent or part of an independent newspaper-driven and focused company. We're the biggest newspaper in that portfolio, so our success is going to be based on the job we're able to do here, and I think that's a good position to be in.
Austin Buettner on KCRW's Which Way LA last summer, shortly after he was appointed CEO and publisher of the Los Angeles Times. As of this morning, he is out of that job, fired by his bosses at the Tribune Company. "I am not departing by choice, nor is this some mutual agreement," he said on Facebook. Tim Ryan, the publisher of the Baltimore Sun, another Tribune paper, will take over. Kevin Roderick is a local media watcher and founder, publisher, and editor of LA Observed, and he's here now. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, so just a year on the job. What did he do wrong in the eyes of his bosses?
Well, you could tell from that clip of Austin Buettner that he planned to be around a while.
Yeah.
He had begun some real reforms in the newsroom of the LA Times. He had kind of reactivated the brand and began to change the image of the brand out in the world. He was a very public face of the LA Times. He started a book club. He was involved in the Festival of Books himself. He had started these newsletters that are going out to a lot of people every morning, trying to connect the LA Times with a new audience and with new advertisers, because he recognized that a lot had to change to take a newspaper like the LA Times and turn it to be successful in the digital age. And he had just gotten that started when everything fell apart.
Yeah, and he also merged with the San Diego Union-Tribune.
Yeah, that was part of the strategy, was to begin to kind of take the LA Times and combine it with some other local media. San Diego was available. I understand that he had made a run at the Orange County Register as well, and maybe other media outlets that we don't know about, to try to form what would be a kind of a mega media powerhouse in the region of Southern California, believing that that was the future of the LA Times and the future of newspapers, the way they're going to look down the road.
Well, his bosses disagreed with his strategy. What didn't they like?
Well, they haven't spoken about it yet. There's been some indications out of Chicago, which is where Tribune Publishing is based, that they were unhappy about the financial performance in the first year that Buettner was on the job. That strikes me as a little bit not quite truthful, not fully truthful anyway, because it had only been a year. All the stock price of this company was underperforming. I'm not sure that any of the other newspapers that the chain owns were doing that much better. But we do know that there was something that sort of a couple of things that probably ticked off Chicago. One was that Austin Buettner was surrounding himself with some kind of high-priced talent, which is not Chicago's way, of vice presidents and others who were close to him, were working directly for him. Apparently pretty highly paid. And a lot of these people came with a political background. So there's actually been speculation that Austin Buettner was building a team that would help him run for office someday.
And run for governor?
Governor, senator, who knows? He had run for mayor briefly in the 2013 race before dropping out after finding out that he really didn't have any support for that. And, I don't know if that's completely true, but that's certainly something that's being said both inside the newsroom at the LA Times and on the outside. Another thing that happened was that Eli Broad, in the last couple of weeks, had made an overture to Tribune Publishing to buy the LA Times out of this company, take it private, and keep Austin Buettner as the publisher. And apparently there's some belief in Chicago that Austin Buettner was in on that bid by Eli Broad and was sharing information with him, and that did not set well with the bosses in Chicago, who were counting on the LA Times as being kind of a foundation asset in this new company.
Well, it certainly seems, reading his Facebook post, which has the title, "My Parting Thoughts," that this was not an amicable parting. that there was quite a clash. It seems almost personal, a clash of personalities.
Yes, there's nothing friendly about the message that was sent. And also, you know, the reason that Austin Buettner took to Facebook, because he says that he was actually cut off from his access to his Los Angeles Times email this morning. So he had to go on Facebook to write a parting thought, even to his staff there in the building. And that indicates a certain, you know, a lot of times when an executive leaves a company, everybody makes it sound like this was a friendly mutual decision, or someone's going on to their, you know, to their first love, hanging out with the family at home again, something like that. None of these niceties in this particular breakup.
Yeah. So, well, at the time when he was hired, it seemed to be that the Tribune Company was going to let the Times be the Times and not try to run things from afar as it had in the past, to some not so great results. Does this indicate that the corporate hand is back in control?
It certainly suggests that there's going to be more direct control from Chicago on what happens at the LA Times. You know, and apparently there has been a desire in Chicago to run all of the newspapers in a common way, to, you know, to leverage the kind of things that they can share with each other, like national advertising and, you know, Hollywood coverage and sports coverage and things like that, that will, you know, bring some efficiencies to this very expensive process of gathering and reporting the news. And that's something that this Tribune Publishing Company, which just spun off from the bigger Tribune Company last year, has talked about wanting to do. But, you know, it was just last year when they brought in Austin Buettner and told him, go, you know, here's the challenge. We like what you're saying. We want you to be the one that's going to lead the LA Times into this new digital future. A lot of changes have to be made. You seem like the guy to do it. And not that much could change in the course of a year. So that's why I think there's, you know, that there was some jealousies going on. There's a CEO in Chicago, Jack Griffin. Perhaps he felt threatened by Austin Buettner, who, again, was running the biggest newspaper in the chain and was making overtures toward, you know, breaking off the LA Times into a separate entity. Remember, Austin Buettner came to this whole affiliation with the LA Times as a potential buyer.
Right.
He was someone a couple of years ago who thought about buying the Times to run as a nonprofit. And after those discussions fell apart, it was, well, you know, why don't you just run the place as publisher? He doesn't need the money. It's not that kind of thing. And that's what they started a year ago.
Okay, so the newsroom is now about 500 people, I understand, and it's the budget is between $70 and $75 million a year. What does all this mean for the workers there? Are they looking at more layoffs possibly in the future, budget cuts at least?
Well, I think it's too soon to tell about that. Already in the works was a newsroom-wide buyout offer that was going to come later this month or in the fall, coming down from Chicago. It's a way to sort of voluntarily and more painlessly reduce the size of the staff and cut the budget. There's a lot of still older senior people at the Times who, you know, the morale's not been really great, and I know of several people who are hoping to take advantage of this buyout and have just been waiting for that to come along. Timothy Ryan, who is the new publisher, he's the publisher of the Baltimore Sun, comes with somewhat of a reputation of being a cutter, and we'll have to see whether, you know, when he gets here and he takes a look at the situation, how much, you know, efficiencies remain to be cut out of the LA Times. You know, Buettner's approach and others has been that you can't cut your way to success.
Yeah, I mean, he says that in his email, that you need to really, he says newspapers must recognize their strength lies in high-quality content developed by world-class journalists with the tools they need to be successful, which would indicate that he would not be in favor of these kinds of cuts. Do you think that that was a possible point of friction?
Possibly, but, you know, I didn't pick up any of that in my reporting, that there were specific cuts handed down from Chicago that Austin Buettner said, I'm not going to do. That would have resonated with people in Los Angeles, because that's what happened 7 or 8 years ago when the Tribune decided it was cost-cutting time, and they put pressures on Los Angeles to reduce. And that's when the editor of the paper, John Carroll, left. The following editor, Dean Baquet, left and went back to the New York Times. A couple of publishers left as well, refusing to make those kind of cuts, saying the same kind of thing that Austin Buettner is saying now. We're, of course, way down the road now. There have been a lot of cuts. The staff is much smaller than it used to be. The revenue is much smaller than it used to be. But it's still, at least where I sit, it's too early to tell whether a new publisher is going to be looking to come in and whack people on expenses. You know, I just don't know whether they're still there and there's that kind of fat to do that with.
All right. Well, thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
Kevin Roderick is founder, publisher, and editor of LA Observed and also a contributor to KCRW. You can hear him every Monday on All Things Considered with Steve Chiotakis. Well, are you an LA Times reader? We want to know why you are, why you like it, or why not, why you gave up reading the paper. If you are a reader, what do you think of the changes that Austin Buettner made in the last year? You can give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY and leave us a message, and we may use it later on in the show or on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. A comedian who sometimes performs in blackface could become the next president of Guatemala. Jimmy Morales received the largest share of the vote yesterday. A runoff is scheduled for October. And this comes as the country is mired in a corruption scandal. The president resigned last week, and he's in jail right now. Jeff Abbott is in Guatemala City. He's a journalist who's been writing about the election for Vice. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us more about Jimmy Morales.
Jimmy Morales is a former comedian who's been campaigning as the anti-status quo candidate. He got his notoriety from doing a television show with his brother, and it was a variety show. And so he was a familiar face for voters who were tired of the corruption and the system of the structure.
Yeah, because of all this corruption, all these scandals that have unfolded recently. Yeah. Well, before we get to that, does Jimmy Morales have any experience in governance?
He tried running in 2011 for a mayor position in one of the larger cities near Guatemala City. He failed miserably. One thing I really would like to make clear is that he's presenting himself as a candidate that's anti-system, anti the status quo as far as scandal goes, but he's just more of the same, really. He's got deep connections to the same people behind Otto Perez Molina.
Who is the president who had to resign last week. Yeah,
the former president.
Right.
So there's deep, deep connections to that.
Well, tell us more about that. How is he connected?
So the FCNA, which is his party, was actually founded by the Veterans Association of the Guatemalan military. And he was approached by one of the founders of the party, who was an operations official. And it became an alliance of opportunity. Morales wanted a way to justify himself as a true politician. The military needed a new face. And now we have this new hydra of the Guatemalan military political system.
So who is facing off against Jimmy Morales?
Sandra Torres came in second. It was a very, very close vote with a businessman, Manuel Balizon, who was a right-wing populist candidate. Sandra Torres is the ex-wife of former President Alvaro Colom, who first ran in 2011 and didn't make it through to the second round, whereas Balizon did make it into the second round of the last election and ran against Otto Perez Molina and lost.
And are there any concerns about her and her ties to the establishment?
Yes, there are. Colom's administration had its own corruption scandals that emerged within it, and they were connected to Sandra Torres as well. And she's really viewed as being the face of the system right now in these elections. She's making big points about, you know, questioning Morales's experience as a politician. So this election is really it's two awful choices. Neither of them have a good background. Neither of them are trustworthy candidates. And each of them have their own alternative motives for being president.
But I guess they were the best of a bad lot because Guatemalans had been outraged. They were protesting for months over what was happening in the current government. Many people have resigned, as we said. The president is now in jail and he may face charges.
Yes.
Give us a quick rundown of what happened in the last few months.
So the administration has been fully discredited through revelations of a massive crime ring operating within the government. There's been 20 weeks of protests since mid-April when these revelations were first made available by a UN anti-impunity, anti-corruption organization referred to as CICIG. And this scandal has already led to the resignation of not only the president, but his vice president, Minister of the Interior, Minister of Defense, and a number of other high-ranking cabinet members. And the thing is, this is a crisis that is deeply embedded in the Guatemalan state, and it's not even close to being over. And that's actually something the protesters have been saying, or have been telling me personally, over the last couple of weeks, is that the elections may have occurred, but the protests are just beginning.
Really? Because, well, they got what they wanted, right? The president resigned.
It was never just about the president. The president became their what they rallied around. Bringing down President Lee was part of it. But really, the backbone of this movement was the structural inequalities in this country. A lot of people told me that they were protesting because of the lack of medicine in hospitals, poor quality of schools, the fact that their politicians were getting rich while, 50% of the population suffers from malnutrition. So there were other issues that were behind these movements. And really, they began to emerge following the resignation of Valdetti on May 8th. It became a movement against really the structural inequalities and the structural corruption of the Guatemalan state.
Jeff Abbott, reporting from Guatemala City for Vice. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. And I hope you guys are able to follow the rest of the story because it's just now beginning.
Coming up, it's Venus versus Serena today at the U.S. Open. How two sisters from Compton shook up the world of tennis. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Serena Williams is chasing her first Grand Slam. That's winning all four major tennis tournaments in the same year. No one has done it since Steffi Graf in 1988. Serena's latest obstacle to Grand Slam glory? Well, it's her older sister, Venus Williams. The Williams sisters face off at the U.S. Open quarterfinals later today. The two women have played each other since they were little girls growing up in Compton, where their father and coach, Richard Williams, fought off gang members just to use the courts, as he wrote in his memoir last year. Here's Richard Williams in a 1992 interview talking about what he'd do if his daughters ever won a major tennis tournament.
I know what I would do now. I would go back to the ghettos of Compton and get some of those gang members who used to protect my daughters from other gang members and bring them to the U.S. Open and Wimbledon. And they would sit in box seats and they would sit there and watch my daughter. And it would give so many other kids the opportunity to see that they can do it. And they would remember Venus and Serena. They would say, boy, they did it. I can do it. That's that little girl. She's living on my street, that little poor girl.
Well, joining me now to talk about the Williams family's legacy in Compton is Makai Ali, board president of the Compton Unified School District. Welcome to you.
Good afternoon. It's such a pleasure to represent the Compton community on your show today.
Well, it's great to have you. And Jim Capel, senior writer at ESPN. Hi there.
Good. How are you doing?
All right.
Beautiful.
Let's start with Makai. You grew up in Compton around the same time as the Williams sisters. And what was it like to play tennis in the neighborhood then?
Well, I could tell you, first and foremost, you did not have many tennis courts within the community then, and you still do not have many tennis courts in the community today. However, the school district is leading the way as far as transforming and assisting the Williams sisters with bringing tennis back to Compton in a very constructive way.
And what does that entail? Are they actually contributing financially?
Well, what that entails is the community of Compton will consider an opportunity on the ballot this coming November to bring about a tremendous amount of restoration to our very aged campuses, which will not only provide new academic buildings, but also state-of-the-art sports facilities, state-of-the-art tennis facilities so that these young students that are currently within the Compton schools and the Compton community can be availed what has benefited the Williams sisters.
And what kind of contributions have they made since they have become, world-renowned athletes?
Well, we're very much appreciative to the Williams sisters for working very closely with many organizations. For example, the Venus and Serena Williams Tennis Academy over at the Arthur Ashe Tennis Center. Many of the students and children within Compton have benefited from that. Let me give an example. A current member of the Compton City Council, her name is Jana Zarita. Her daughter, now, of course, her daughter's tennis skills aren't quite at the level of the Williams sisters, but she's been inspired by by Serena, who has won four consecutive Grand Slam titles and is known around the world and has represented Compton in such a positive light. This young child, her name is Chanel Crutchfield, she stands as what we would hope to see in the future, many more young African-American and Latino girls looking at tennis as an option, looking at tennis as an opportunity, a sport that's not as traditionally has been made available to African-American or Latino children throughout America.
And Jim Capel, turning to you, let's talk about their rivalry, the sisters' rivalry in the match tonight. When they first started playing each other professionally, and they have met up some 26 times professionally, Venus won most of the matches, but that changed, around 2002? And now Serena is number one seeded in the world. Venus is number 23.
Yeah, well, Serena's definitely she's probably the best women's player ever. And Venus has been spectacular herself, and she had a number of health issues, but she's coming back. She's having a very good year this year. Like you said, this will be their 27th meeting, and they've gotten used to playing each other. They used to not like it very much, but they're used to more of it. But their family still doesn't like watching it. Orsine, who their mother Orsine, is not going to go to the match tonight. And their rivalry made them each better. They just played each other, and these are two of the best players ever. And playing each other, of course, makes you better.
Well, critics have said that their matchups have been sort of pro forma and not full of passion, let's say. Would you agree with that?
Well, no, I would not agree with that. They, you're playing a sibling. There's going to be mixed emotions involved with that sort of thing. But you're also going to want to win. I mean, they would not be at the place where they are in the world of tennis if they did not try hard to win. And there was the ugly incident or the ugly controversy at Indian Wells long ago. But I don't think it was fair, and I don't. I think hopefully we've gotten past that, and I think that they will play a very good match tonight. And the way Serena plays, it'll probably go three matches, and then when she gets her back against the wall, she is almost impossible to beat.
So you referred to Indian Wells. This was in 2001 when Venus pulled out. She said she had tendonitis, and fans booed Serena. They thought that it was fixed, that she pulled out, and then Serena boycotted until this year, right?
Yeah, she came back this year, and again, I do not think that it was a fixed by any stretch. I think that she was genuinely injured, and she pulled out. And these things happen many times in tennis. Players often pull out, mm-hmm. and hopefully, people can get past that and realize, hey, these things happen. And just because they happen to be sisters does not mean that they collude. They are very, very fierce competitors, and they want to beat each other just as much as they want to beat anybody else.
But still, there must be some incredible pressure on Venus, because this is Serena's chance to win the Grand Slam. And if Serena loses, that's the end of her dream, at least for now.
Isn't that the interesting part of it, and the tough part of your sibling? You want to beat them. Venus would not have won as many of the slams as she has won without really wanting to win. And now she got to play her sister and try to prevent her from being the first person since Steffi Graf to complete a calendar year Grand Slam. So she doesn't want to do that. On the other hand, she doesn't want to lose either. She wants to win. So she will push Serena as hard as she can. And they'll probably, if Venus loses, I would imagine that she would be very upset for a few minutes, and then she'd get over it, and she'd be very happy for her sister. But when they get out there on the court, I think they will be trying their absolute hardest to win.
And back to you, Mekhi Ali. Is there excitement in the neighborhood for this match tonight?
Oh, absolutely. There's a tremendous amount of excitement. Again, we have to remember that Compton is much more than what people are currently believe. There's a tremendous amount of misconceptions about young people within the community. And when you look at the accomplishments of folks like Richard Sherman and Dr. Dre and the Williams sisters, we also boast a tremendous amount of doctors, lawyers, and teachers, and people who truly care about, of course, the American dream. The community is exceedingly excited. Someone said, "Who are you rooting for?" I said, "Well, I'm rooting for both, because both represent Compton. And if Compton could be brought forth to the world in a positive light, then I believe that all of us should applaud that."
Okay, who are you really rooting for?
Both. I got to root for both, and I got to root for both because at the very end of the day, I got a huge community who love the Williams sisters.
And Jim Capel, how watched will this event be tonight?
Oh, I think it'll be very, very well watched, not just in Compton. I agree completely with him that I went down there and saw on the courts, and Compton has a very bad rap that it does not deserve. It's much improved. I think this will be a very, very well watched match. Happening on Tuesday, there's nothing else going on to compete against it too much. And it's going to be a very dramatic one. And I think a lot of people are going to be wearing it, will be watching it, other than the Williams family, who don't like watching the two of them play.
Okay.
Having to root for one of them.
All right. Well, it begins at 4 o'clock Pacific. Jim Capel, senior writer at ESPN, and Mekhi Ali, board president of Compton Unified School District. Thank you both.
Thank you.
All right. Who are you rooting for tonight? Big Sis, Venus Williams, or Grand Slam Serena? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, she was the first Hollywood super agent. No one said no to Sue Mengers.
It was suggested to her that she might want to pick up John Travolta as a client, and she said, "I have no interest in that greasy little sweat hog."
The rise and fall of a unique Hollywood character after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
What do these five famous names have in common? Barbara Streisand, Ryan O'Neill, Ally McGraw, Gene Hackman, and Gore Vidal. Well, besides mere fame and fortune, they have Sue Mengers, their talent agent. She is friend, advisor, psychoanalyst, job getter, and job turner down for each of them. And she makes the deals that make them rich.
That's Mike Wallace in a 60 Minutes profile of Hollywood super agent Sue Mengers. The piece aired in 1975 at the height of Mengers' power. She represented a Rolodex of the biggest stars of the time, and every studio head took her call. But unlike other agents who toil behind the scenes making deals for their clients, Sue Mengers was famous in her own right. A new biography has just come out about her. It's called Can I Go Now? The Life of Sue Mengers, Hollywood's First Super Agent. The author is Brian Kellow, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much.
Well, she was the first super agent and also the first woman to be a super agent, but she didn't start out that way. She wanted to be an actress when she was younger, and that didn't happen, and she began her job, her ascendancy as a receptionist. So I wonder if you could just describe how she transitioned from receptionist to agent.
Sure. Sue Mengers wanted to grow up to be an actress, idolized Ingrid Bergman and wanted to be a glamorous movie star, and eventually did take some acting lessons, but gave it up fairly quickly, wound up becoming a receptionist at MCA, one of the big talent agencies of the time. And she worked her way up in a string of secretarial positions at various agencies, large and small. And then she finally wound up as a full-fledged agent.
But how did she become an agent? How did she? Because in that time, this was in the early 60s, it was very difficult, right, for women to enter that profession. So how did she do it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she was, you were basically in the secretarial pool, and that was about it. She was a very, very aggressive person, and she was very imaginative. And she got herself noticed by a lot of key people as a secretary. She would do outlandish things to try to attract attention or get a client to sign with the agency. And she was not even responsible for doing this.
She's just a typist, but, basically, then.
Yeah, well, she was a secretary. Yeah, exactly. And she was a high-level secretary. I mean, she was given a lot of contact with the star clients, which she loved.
And these are clients like Marlon Brando and
Grace
Kelly, Marilyn
Monroe.
Right,
absolutely. And she loved that. She had always been a starstruck kid. And she thought, well, this is a great life. I want to be part of it. And she sort of began scheming and plotting to become a bigger part of the business. And this company, Baum & Newborn, these two fellows who were running it, noticed her and gave her chance, basically. They just took a chance on her. And she had no education beyond high school. I mean, it couldn't happen now. She'd have to flash her MBA at them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was a different time. And she was a colorful personality, and it was a time of personalities. And I think they just thought she had the goods, and they gave her the opportunity, and she ran with it.
And so then she moved to Hollywood. And then
she moved to Hollywood in 1968. Yeah.
And so how was she able to sign such big stars? Because eventually, as I said in the introduction, she ends up signing the biggest stars in the world at that time.
Well, I asked Barry Diller, one of the 210 people, I think, that I interviewed for this book, I asked him to comment as a former studio head about her selling ability. And he said, she was the greatest negative seller I've ever seen. And I said, what do you mean by that? And Barry Diller said, what I mean is that if you were considering a particular star for a particular script, she could demolish that person and tell you exactly why you should not hire him and hire her client instead. Now, I think she worked in signing people. I think she worked in a similar way. I think she would say, why are you with that idiot agent of yours? He's not doing anything with you. Come with me. I can do fantastic things. And she had a very forceful and a very seductive personality, and she won a lot of people over.
One of the people that she won over was Barbara Streisand, who became like a sister to her. How did she meet Barbara Streisand?
She saw Barbara Streisand early on in a review called Another Evening with Harry Stoons. And she later told Streisand that she hadn't thought that she had any ability or talent or promise at all, which Barbara Streisand, when I interviewed her, thought was very, very funny. But she saw her in the show, and then she followed her in her other Broadway shows, I Can Get It For You Wholesale and Funny Girl, of course, and became a huge fan of hers. And Barbara Streisand eventually had come under the management of Freddie Fields and David Beagleman, who were part of CMA. And they handled her, really, and Sue was very much in the background. And over time, they both went in other directions professionally, and Sue sort of took over by default. And the first big coup that she scored in the Streisand career was What's Up, Doc?
Which was directed by Peter Bogdanovich, who was also one of her clients, right?
Also one of her clients, and co-starring Ryan O'Neal, who was also one of her clients. And she put the whole package together, and that was really a big, big thing in her career.
I want to play another bite from that 1975 60 Minutes profile. And this is Sue Mengers at her height, working the phones at her office.
Hi, darling. When are you leaving? Oh, I envy you. My God, I wish I were going. Love to Tatum. Bye.
Jagger on 5.
Hi, Mick. Will Bianca be there?
Mr. Zanuck? Hold on a second, please. We're Sue Mengers.
Hi, Richard. I just am crazy about that script you sent me. I'm just mad for it. I think it's terrific.
So this was Sue Mengers at the top of her game. And she sounds in that clip, you know, really sweet and polite. But she, according to your book, she really had a mouth on her.
Oh, God, yes. Absolutely. And when she was really, really comfortable around you, she would let that fly. And it was part of her humor and it was part of her charm in a funny way. I think part of the secret to her power and her success and her ability to charm and persuade people is that she was a great truth teller. And in Hollywood, that is not something that you find around every corner.
And there was also the recreational time, which I guess she saw perhaps as work time. She would throw these parties, these really famous dinner mm-hmm. parties, where she would show off her star friend. She called them Twinklies.
Twinklies.
Yeah. Were these affairs just places to let your hair down, or was she actually working?
Oh, she was working every minute. I don't think there was a lot of relaxation at these parties. I know there wasn't, because a lot of people that I interviewed for the book have talked about it. Allie McGraw told me that she and Candace Bergen would meet before they were summoned to one of these parties and sort of work up their courage together, because they knew that they were going to be on display.
Before and directors? So directors would
be
there?
Before directors and producers, yeah.
There was a lot of drugs, right?
Oh, there were a lot of drugs, and there was, you know, there was wine flowing. And although Sue herself was not much of a drinker, pot was her recreational drug of choice. But I think they were very fun parties. But there was also a great level of tension underneath it, because it was all about getting the next job. And she would seat people together very adroitly. If she knew that a certain director had a script that might be right for a certain actor, she would pair them off at dinner. That's how Candace Bergen got her career-changing part in Starting Over. Sue seated her next to the director of the picture, Alan Pakula. Hmm. You know, she put Lauren Hutton next to Paul Schrader, and Lauren Hutton then got cast in American Gigolo. She did things like that all the time.
Did she have any spectacular flops or mistakes?
Well, the most spectacular mistake that she made was putting Barbra Streisand in a movie called All Night Long, which was to be directed by Sue's husband, Jean-Claude Tremont. It was released in 1981, and there was an actress that probably lots of people will remember named Lisa Eichhorn, who was a rising actress at the time, very much kind of on a par with Meryl Streep in the late 70s. And Lisa was put into the picture as the leading lady opposite Gene Hackman. And after a couple of weeks of filming, she was rather unceremoniously replaced by Barbra Streisand at Sue's manipulation.
And was this to help her husband's movie?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think Sue just saw a great opportunity to boost her husband's career by putting the biggest star in Hollywood in his film. But it had very terrible repercussions for everybody, because the film was undeservedly, I think, a terrible flop. And it ended Streisand's working relationship with Sue.
So Barbra Streisand left her.
Very, very shortly after, yeah.
And this is in 1981. I mean, it almost right. sounds like a Greek tragedy that she was undone by her own actions, because then other stars started leaving her, and it was really the beginning of the end.
I do think it was very damaging to Sue's reputation. She no longer had the jewel in the crown. And then she, when she lost Streisand, in my opinion, just lost her taste for the whole game so completely. It just wasn't worth it to her to play the game anymore if she didn't have the biggest star.
But why didn't she adapt and get the next biggest stars? The next generation.
Well, that was the great mistake of her career. She made a dreadful mistake in not developing young talent, in not spotting young talent. She thought that was beneath her.
She used to jeer at some of her colleagues when they would be going to some little black box theater in Los Angeles where they'd heard about this fantastic young actor and they thought they might be able to do something. She thought that was a ridiculous waste of time.
Did Sue Mengers understand the power of television? Did she try to get her actors into big TV roles?
No. Another big mistake in her career. She thought television was second or third best, and she looked down on it. She was rather unkind to a lot of the other people in her agency who worked in the TV department. She didn't think much of what they did. I think that she was an elitist. I mean, she was circulating with Barbara Streisand and Gene Hackman and Anne Margaret and Candace Bergen and Peter Bogdanovich and many, many others of that time. And she had no interest in representing somebody like Carol Burnett or Carol O'Connor or Sonny Bono or the people who were the big TV stars. It was suggested to her that she might want to pick up John Travolta as a client, and she said, "I have no interest in that greasy little sweat hog." And because at the time he was on Welcome Back, Kotter, where he played one of the sweat hogs. And
this is before Saturday Night Fever.
And this was before Saturday Night Fever. And so again, she didn't have foresight. She could see very well what to do at any given moment with a star, and she had good script judgment and all that, but she couldn't see the potential in somebody who hadn't arrived yet. And then, of course, she spent a lot of time trying to get John Travolta, and she never did.
Are there any Sue Mengers-type agents nowadays?
I think there have been, over the years, quite a few people who probably modeled their style to some degree on her. But I don't think they had the same magic. I think she was an absolute original. Nobody dealt with people, with actors, with studio heads quite the way she did. It was a confidence and a chutzpah and a magic that was all her own. So I don't think anybody has really succeeded in recapturing that magic, no.
Brian Kello, he's the author of Can I Go Now? The Life of Sue Mengers, Hollywood's First Super Agent. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
No. Superhost Warren Olney is here now.
Back.
Hi, welcome back.
Well, thank you. You know, who likes vacation after
Nobody.
All? You know, when you
Nobody
love your
does.
Job, it's so good to be
Well, your
back.
Listeners don't like it, so.
Well, we are here and doing a very interesting subject today, which is Saudi Arabia. Nobody paid a lot of attention, but when the King of Saudi Arabia arrived in Washington last week, he had 600 cars at Andrews Air Force Base. There's a picture of them all lined up. We didn't talk about that on our program, or we won't. But we will talk about what the Saudis wanted in exchange for, not getting too upset about the about the Iran nuclear deal. Of course, they are. And they're upset about Assad and the president's failure to do anything after Assad crossed the red line.
And yet they're being criticized for not taking in refugees.
They are, of course, and they're not taking in the refugees. So they're also being criticized for what they're doing in Yemen and for what they do at home, publicized executions on the street, beheadings of people for nonviolent crimes, things of that kind. Was this an opportunity to get them to do something about that? We'll get some interesting answers on that.
Okay. Coming up at 1 o'clock, a great discussion as always.
Indeed.
Thank you, Warren Olney. And coming up on this program, a little dessert. The history of the quintessential LA food. No, not kale smoothies. We're talking the cheeseburger. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. What comes to mind when you think quintessential LA food? Kale smoothies, egg white omelets. Well, how about the cheeseburger? Yep, the meaty greasy cheeseburger is said to have been invented in Pasadena nearly 90 years ago. But there's been some fighting lately over who really was first to put cheese to beef. Catherine Spires is food editor for KCET, and she joins me now to tell us more about this.
Hi.
Beef. I know. I had to say it. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay. So what is the main argument over who invented the cheeseburger?
Well, everyone wants to take credit for having invented the cheeseburger. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But I think that it can safely go to a 16-year-old in Pasadena in 1924. His name was Louis Sternberger, appropriately
enough. Sternberger?
I know.
Really?
Of course. It had to be. He was actually working at his father's restaurant. It was called The Right Spot, and it was a quick service restaurant. Sadly, it doesn't exist anymore, but it seems like he might have been the first person to think to slap some cheese on a burger as it was on the griddle.
And does he get credit?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Since everyone wants to take credit for a cheeseburger, other people will. He sadly called it the cheese hamburger. So it's true that there's a place in Kentucky in 1934 who was the first one, apparently, to say cheeseburger.
Mm.
And then there's someone else in Denver who got the patent on it, but it seems like he wasn't a litigious type, so he just let everyone call it a cheeseburger. But I do think that Lewis gets credit for being the first one to think of the cheeseburger.
A patent on the cheeseburger?
Yeah, isn't that funny? The Library of Congress actually was like, you get to use, if you want, you can be the only person to say cheeseburger.
So just to call it that, but anyone could make a cheeseburger.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
So it's kind of like singing the happy birthday song.
Exactly like
everyone that. Everyone
does it. Right.
Okay, so Pasadena has this annual cheeseburger week.
Yes, they do. It's been going on for a few years now, and it's basically, it's kind of like a Dine LA, but it's specifically about cheeseburgers, and it's specifically in Pasadena, and it pays homage to Louis Sternberger and his creation.
And I imagine there are many variations that have come out of that.
Yes, and quickly, too. I think as soon as he kickstarted the idea of putting things on hamburgers, everyone really went for it. And even as early as 1928, there's a menu from a place in South LA. It was called Odell's. And they, in addition to cheese, were adding chili to their burger. And they were adding spaghetti to their
spaghetti.
Burger. Uh-huh. Topping the burger with spaghetti. You could actually get the cheese and the chili and the spaghetti all on one horror show of a meal, and it cost 40 cents.
And $50 in napkins.
Right.
It's funny how that hasn't persevered or hasn't stayed with us, the spaghetti burger.
Yeah, not the Shocking. Spaghetti burger. Chili burgers, though.
Chili burgers.
Those are around. And anyone who went to USC thinks that Tommy's is some sort of culinary revelation and that they serve the best burgers and the chili is part of it. I don't get it, but I didn't go to USC, so.
Aha, throw down.
Yeah.
Okay, so what burger joint near UCLA do you know? So, well, that goes to show you that there's a healthy competition still with burgers in
yeah,
terms of creating them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for whatever reason in Los Angeles, burgers are actually kind of one of our points of culinary pride. Everyone's got one, and people are doing downmarket versions and upmarket versions, and there's a wide range of burgers to choose from in LA.
Do you have a favorite?
I mean, they're all my
favorites. I know.
I know this is kind of trite, but I do love In-N-Out. So yeah. There's that in terms of the chains. And they're a Southern California creation as well.
And
their
McDonald's.
Hometowns. Yes. So McDonald's actually predates In-N-Out by 8 years. They started in 1940, but they were a barbecue joint when they first started.
McDonald's was.
McDonald's was a barbecue joint. They also sold peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, because why not? But then In-N-Out opened in 1948, and coincidentally, that same year, McDonald's closed for a couple months and reopened as a burger joint.
Aha.
Mm-hmm.
And they've gone their separate ways in terms of franchising. And
yeah, totally different animals now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Animal style.
Aha.
Aha. Okay, so back to cheeseburgers. Mm-hmm. You still think you're with In-N-Out on the cheeseburger?
Yeah, I am, although there are some people doing interesting versions. You know, with the changing food tides right now, grass-fed beef is something that people are more interested in. So Bel Campo does two different burgers. Both of them are great, but they use grass-fed beef, which adds a different flavor profile. And then Republique is also specifically using grass-fed, and their burger is highly regarded as well. And then Castles, which was a Koreatown institution for years, they recently reopened, and they're doing burgers that are really popular right now, too. And that's a simple version of a burger, a cheeseburger. And those are more traditional. And then you've got places like Bad Mash downtown. That is an Indian restaurant, and they have a lamb cheeseburger.
Hmm.
So there's lots of room to experiment and still call something a cheeseburger.
Yeah. Can you have a vegan cheeseburger?
No. I say no
she
to that.
She said with disgust in her voice.
That is neither cheese nor burger.
Well, it does go to the schizophrenic nature of Los Angeles, because on the one hand, you have, you know, healthy food. And then on the other hand, it's also burger and donut town.
You know, it absolutely is. I feel like it's a lot of people who come to LA and see all the beautiful people and think they must only be eating salads. But oh my gosh, we are a city of binge eaters. Absolutely. We love all that junky stuff. And why not?
Oh, you just made me really hungry. Catherine Spires, food editor for KCET. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi there, Jolie Myers. Favorite burger?
Apple pan.
Yes.
It's so good.
Delicious.
Apple pan burger, then go over to the Landmark for like a noon show. Yes, except during the weekdays because we're on
pie,
at noon.
And then go back for
and
pie.
And then go back for pie, make it a sandwich, much like a burger. So we asked our listeners what their favorite cheese was to put on a burger, and everyone had an opinion, of course. Monica Scott, who is our social media manager, says nacho cheese.
Really?
Go big or go home, which I can sign on with. Joey H. tweets blue cheese. Sick Boy says extra sharp cheddar any day of the week. And Eric says pepper jack, spelled with about six A's. I think that that's for emphasis. Sounds good to me. How about all of them? Why do we have to pick?
All together?
All like together.
It could be a fondue.
That's right.
We fondue burger.
Mixed cheese fondue all over the burger.
All right, time for lunch now. Bye-bye. Jolie Myers, thank you for that. Warren Olney up next with To The Point. So stay right here, even if you're eating at your desk. Keep it right here. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.